Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, the newspaper said Governor Rick Snyder was pushing a $425 million shift that would take money from schools and put it for other spending. Late yesterday, Governor Snyder backed off that. His spokesperson says it's the right thing to do, but not the right time to do it. Joining us now are Susan Demas, the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. So, Susan, why is shifting hundreds of millions of dollars away from schools the right thing to do, as the governor's spokesman says?
Well, in Michigan, we have two main funds that fund all of our departments and government, the school aid fund and the general fund. And it's no secret that the general fund has been in trouble for a long time. First, you know, very much because of our recession, but then even with a recovery, we're still not up to pre-recession levels of spending. We just don't have the tax revenue coming in for many reasons. And the school aid fund has been much more stable. We already use the school aid fund for non-K-12 purposes. It funds higher education now, which is a break in precedent. And I think the governor would like to take from some of the school aid fund to operate the rest of government, because that's a better alternative than a tax increase. But in reality, that $425 million would translate to a pure pupil cut of over $200. So that's fairly significant.
Ken, this on again, off again, governor pushing for it one day and backing off of it next day, what's going on?
Well, if the governor wants to cut funding to schools to fund other areas of government, he ought to just say it. He tried to position this as some kind of accounting change that would temporarily cut funding to schools, but he'd make it up later, sort of, trust me, which I don't think goes very far these days. But, you know, the float of the idea and lame duck, because sometimes you can get stuff through during the chaos and schools and others raised the alarm, and he clearly backed off. But I don't, someone would have to explain to me why it's ever a good idea to cut funding to schools to fund other areas right now.
It's not the only plan that's been shelved this week. There were a lot of state-mandated cuts of health care and pension funds for workers and retirees in local government that were up. Then firefighters and police officers started showing up at the state capitol to demonstrate against those cuts, and the Republicans backing the plan shelved it. Susan, there are protests all the time. Why did this change things?
I think that it's a very hard argument to make that you should be taking away retirement benefits from people who put their lives on the line every day. And certainly police unions have, you know, been very supportive of Republicans in the past. So, you know, you're going after one of your constituencies, which is always very difficult politically. And, you know, the timing of this happened to be when the Wayne State University police officer was killed and during his funeral. And meanwhile, up in Lansing, you had people who couldn't come and testify because they were at that funeral. So it's not terribly surprising to me that this turned out to be an incredibly tone-deaf political thud. But nonetheless, I think it demonstrates that this is still an issue on a lot of people's radar, because there are, you know, serious costs involved. And I'm not sure that we've seen the last of these measures, especially when it comes to teachers who, you know, as we all know, the MEA and Republicans, the teachers union, they don't really see eye to eye very often.
Ken, the Republicans who proposed this package of bill had to know that the optics would be bad when firefighters and police started showing up on the state capitol lawn. Why did it make a difference if they knew that was coming anyway?
Lester, I find this lame duck session to be very strange in the sense that four big issues, you know, the teacher pension, municipal retiree health benefits you're talking about, the governor's proposal to cut schools, and this TIFA program to, you know, development, economic development, primarily for Detroit, but other areas, four big issues get floated and then pulled. And that's just so unusual. And lame duck, you normally, if you're going to float these big issues, you get them done. You've figured out a way ahead of time. You've anticipated the protest, like Right to Work a few years ago, and you just do it. And the fact that all four of these issues sort of get kind of floated and run up the flagpole, and then protests occur and they pull them, and that I just find quite odd and strange. It's just so unusual because, like I said, you normally you don't float it unless you're going to do it. The last one standing here seems to be the energy package.
So is this a matter of these guys just don't have the experience because they're term limited, and by the time they get to speaker, they don't know how to do the job well enough? They're just 2 years or 4 years into the job?
Well, I mean, they've done it before. You know, term limited lawmakers have used lame duck the way it's been used in the past. You can agree or disagree with it, whether you think it's good process or good government. But I don't have an explanation. You know, Susan's there probably more on a day-to-day basis and have better day-to-day contacts than I do. I just find this extremely odd that they didn't have their ducks in a row here.
So, Susan, we're looking to for the answer. What's going on?
Well, I agree with Ken that it is rather unusual. I mean, lame duck is the time that you run unpopular bills and you ram them through. That's what lame duck is for. And a lot of these issues, no, they would not be terribly popular, but let's face it, a lot of voters are not paying attention. All of us have just gone through probably the strangest presidential election in our lifetime. The holidays are coming up. And if there's a time that you want to go and take away benefits for police officers, this is probably your best time. And, you know, clearly you do have legislative leaders who are not the best at marshaling their troops and, you know, in taking on heavy fire. I think, you know, Jace Bulger was much more adept at that than Kevin Goddard is. And, you know, certainly Governor Snyder has never been a political animal and clearly didn't have the stomach to fight it out on his cost shift for between the school aid fund and the general fund, you know, even though he put it out there and said it was important to him. So I think that it raises some questions about what we can expect in the last 2 years of Governor Snyder's term, because, you know, if you're not willing to fight for things in lame duck, we might be in for a pretty interesting couple sessions.
That is Susan Dima. She's the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and we've been hearing from Ken Sikkema, the senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Hope you guys have a nice weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. We live in a throwaway society. Things are made cheaply, and when we're finished with them, we toss them out. It goes for furniture, too. People put couches out on the curb. In a college town such as Ann Arbor at the end of the year, there are lots of couches at the curb. In East Lansing, I think they burn them. But we used to reupholster furniture. In fact, some people still do. And in this installment of our series, Artisans of Michigan, we visit an upholsterer. In a quiet neighborhood in Ann Arbor, we met Carol Butcher, who runs her business, The Great Cover-Up, out of her home. Now, Butcher used to work in the corporate world for 20 years. She was out of work for a short time and started recovering furniture as a hobby. Then she got another pretty good corporate job, and she hated it.
All I kept thinking about was upholstery. So, believe it or not, I put in my notice after a few weeks of work. I started doing upholstery for a living. First 2 years, pretty darn scary. But now, wow, I think I've been doing this for 13, 14 years. And I'm constantly busy. I have like a 3 to 5 month backlog at any given time. And I love what I do. And I found out I'm good at it.
Butcher was told if she loved doing upholstery as a hobby, she really shouldn't turn it into a business because she'd end up hating it. She ignored that advice and she still loves it. She spends a lot of time in her basement workshop, surrounded by sewing machines, bolts of fabric, and hand tools. Most of the work, almost all of it, is done by hand. She says there's something therapeutic about the work. In fact, she sometimes has a sort of Tom Sawyer whitewashing the fence thing going on.
I have friends who are more than willing to come over and do what I'm doing right now, just because it's just satisfying. So I think satisfaction would probably be the first thing. It's very satisfying. Really, who doesn't want to hammer things? Who doesn't want to see the transformation as you work through it?
She even tried to get me to give it a try. Yeah, no, I know that trick. Butcher says the great cover-up is working out well enough that she can kind of pick and choose the job she wants to do. She'll refer some customers to other upholsterers in the area. She likes working on antique pieces. Not exclusively, but she finds them more challenging. Which brings us back to that whole throwaway society question.
When is it cost-effective to get something upholstered?
I tell people it's cost-effective if you've got a really solid frame. It's something that's going to last for a while. And then the time and the money that we put into it is going to pay off. If you've bought a sofa that was more economically priced to begin with, the frame is a little dodgy, the padding gets shot pretty quickly, then no, it's not worth it. A lot of times, though, somebody might buy a $10 chair at the garage sale, and it's got a fabulous frame. So I tell them, it will be worth it.
Carol Butcher of The Great Cover-Up in Ann Arbor, the latest in our series, Artisans of Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A recent court case in London has been raising the profile of the cryonics industry and the Cryonics Institute, which is located in Clinton Township in Michigan. It's one of only three cryonics storage facilities in the world. The court case revolved around the rights of a terminally ill 14-year-old British girl who wanted to have her body frozen upon death in the hope of being resuscitated in the future. Her parents had opposing views, and they had to go to court. The judge upheld her right to be cryogenically frozen. She died on October 17th, and her body was transferred to the Cryonics Institute earlier this month. Joining us is Professor Hank Greeley. He's a professor of law and genetics at Stanford. So let's talk about the process. She was delivered into the hands of cryonics. Each one has a slightly different method, but the main idea is to freeze and preserve the body. What problems are there with that process?
So if you're dealing with small enough bits of life, you can do that successfully. We can freeze sperm, we can freeze embryos, we can freeze eggs, and most, though not all of the time, when you revive them, they can function. The problem is when you get to bigger things, they don't freeze very well. The larger an object is, the harder it is to freeze it. And the more likely there will be, or the more certain it is, that there will be damage to the object when you freeze it. Sometimes that damage is caused by ice crystals forming inside cells. Sometimes it's caused by ice crystals forming outside the cells in the area of the body between cells. Sometimes it's caused by salt concentrations or by chemicals that are used to make cryopreservation more plausible. Bottom line is no one has yet come anywhere close to bringing back to life even a mouse or even an organism smaller than a mouse because of the cellular damage that freezing does.
I know that Cryonics Institute talks about a process they use that removes a lot of the water so that when these people in future years, decades, centuries, when they try to resuscitate them, that crystallized water damage that you're talking about won't happen. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, if they could successfully revive a mouse, I would listen to them a lot more carefully. But there's some plausibility to it. The problem, of course, is what's happening to the cells? What damage are you doing to the cells in the process of removing the water? Leaving aside the fact that they do a relatively slow freeze, what damage is being done to the cells and the tissues during the 5 days in which they're freezing people let alone however many days it takes to get the corpse to their facility. The damage is going on throughout that time. Removing the water may prevent, may or may not, I haven't seen anything they've published on it, but may or may not prevent some forms of damage, but it may create other forms of damage. And what's really important here is that they really want to freeze and successfully revive the brain in all of its complexity and glory. The goal is to bring back the person. And it is true that neuroscientists think that the person is physically encoded in the brain, but the brain is incredibly complicated. It's got a billion cells. Those cells make connections with each other, the neurons do, that are called synapses, and there are about 10 trillion synapses in a human brain. Even if you didn't have the cells damaged, if the synapses are damaged, that's going to do damage to the brain. There are also chemicals at different points in the brain that are really important, as far as we can tell, to consciousness. So you might, in theory, be able to bring back a finger, but bringing back a brain is much, much more complicated. And I think, at least for the foreseeable future, it's as close to impossible as I'm willing to say anything is in science. Even if this did work and you were able to bring back and revive a brain, it's a dead brain. It's a brain from someone who has already died. And how much damage that in itself causes is another huge question mark about this whole procedure.
Of course, they have on their website a lot of explainers about how the process works and keeping the body alive through a breathing machine and other things until that moment that they are ready to start the process of cryonics. So they have a lot of answers to questions from experts like you, but it sounds like you're going to remain skeptical until we see that resuscitated mouse.
Right, or until that they publish in the peer-reviewed literature something showing exquisitely fine preservation of a frozen brain. You know, by the way, they can't keep a living brain alive while they freeze it, because in that case, the person wouldn't be dead. The brain has to be dead before the person can be declared dead. If you freeze somebody whose brain is still alive, you're actually committing murder. So they have answers. And let me be clear, I'm not accusing them of fraud. I think people often are extremely optimistic, particularly about things that they do and they believe in.
Yeah, and they're making no promises that this is going to work.
And I think that's important, although there is kind of an implicit promise that it might work, or else why would they offer it for $40,000 or so per corpse? If they were making claims, more broad claims, I think it could be a fraud case. But right now, as long as they're being honest about the lack of any current ability to bring it back and are just waving their hands about possible future use, I think it's an incredible waste of money, but we let people waste money all the time.
Right, exactly.
In a way, you could think about it as just another form of either burial or, well, another form of dealing with human remains. You can be buried, you can be cremated, or you can be frozen.
Sounds like high-stakes gambling to me. That's what I see it as.
Either way, you're a corpse. If you want to spend $40,000 on a funeral, maybe spending $40,000 on being frozen isn't all that much different.
So how popular are these? There are three of them in the world. Does this mean this business model probably doesn't have a great future, or are these three businesses really, really busy?
So I don't know about the Russian business. I don't know the details on the Russian business. The one in Arizona, Alcor, says it has about 150, I think, corpses preserved, human corpses. They will also freeze pets. I think the Michigan one has about 100 to 150 preserved. They've both been in business for multiple decades. So if you think about a total of, say, 300 in the United States over 30 years, that doesn't sound like a very effective business model. One thing they do is sell memberships to living people, so they're getting some money from people who are still alive, some of whom ultimately decide not to be frozen. Let me put it this way. If it looked like a really profitable business model, I think we'd have more than two small companies doing it.
And, of course, one of them is non-profit, not-for-profit, so maybe it's just like like a cemetery, except a lot colder, because you've got this perpetuity funding that keeps up the maintenance, and maybe that's all you need. Maybe there's not really a, a need for big investment.
Maybe. The fact that something's nonprofit doesn't necessarily mean that people aren't benefiting from it, though.
Oh, we know that. We're aware of that. I want to ask you one final question, and this is not so much a science question, but sort of an ethics question. Do you think this is ethical in that the results are uncertain and we're basically investing in a wish and a hope?
I wouldn't offer this service myself. It is not consistent with my own personal view of how I want to spend my life in an ethical way. On the other hand, if you really believe that there is a chance, and if you tell competent adults, 14-year-old issue comes up in part because she wasn't an adult, she's old enough to have reasonable decisions. If you tell them the truth about how uncertain it is, and they decide they want to go forward, is astrology unethical? Is the lottery unethical? There are a lot of ways that we convince people to waste their money that our society allows and even encourages.
That's Professor Hank Greeley. He's a professor of law and genetics at Stanford. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for calling me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. At one time, Detroit's black families had one of the highest home ownership rates in the nation. Now, that home ownership rate is among the lowest. Every year in Detroit, thousands of people lose their homes to tax foreclosures. In many cases, it's unnecessary. The city is accused of illegal taxes and denying tax exemptions homeowners deserve.
Jackson, go sit.
When I got to Daryl and Alyssa Beaver's house, I was greeted by Jackson, their small dog. They've been living in a three-bedroom, two-bath, 1,600-square-foot home on Detroit's east side. There are a lot of nice houses in this neighborhood. The Beavers have been renting with the idea of eventually buying the home from their landlord, a friend of theirs. But Alyssa says a few months back, they didn't see or hear from the landlord for a while.
And so we went over to his house, and definitely he found out the landlord passed away. And then we found out it was like maybe 4 years worth of back taxes owed
on the house, and it wasn't being paid. So we got a foreclosure letter.
This is more than an inconvenience for the Beavers. It's more than just having to move. They've been working and spending their own money on this rental house.
We fixed the house up to move into it, to live in it. We painted everything. We fixed all everything in the house. The floors, we did everything. In the kitchen as well.
So you're invested in this house?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We put the furnace in, we put the hot water tank in, we did everything ourselves.
Everything.
The house was auctioned off for taxes. The Beavers save some money and work with the United Community Housing Coalition to put in a bid for the home. They didn't get it. It sold for $4,400. It's worth around $40,000. They'll soon meet with a new landlord to determine rent or make arrangements to purchase the house, presumably at market price, or learn when they have to be out. They've already received an eviction notice. The Housing Coalition will help them find a new place to live if it can. Ted Phillips is the executive director of the nonprofit advocacy group. The coalition helps thousands of people facing tax foreclosure in Detroit to stay in their homes.
Make sure if there are ways to get out of foreclosure, there are various kinds of payment plans and what have you. We work with them to do that. We try to make work with them so they're not throwing money away. And what I mean by that is if somebody owes $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 worth of taxes, they have no business paying $2,000 or $3,000 and losing the house anyway, you know. So we try to common sense type stuff.
Phillips says the city has worked to reassess properties that were overvalued and overtaxed, but that job is not finished. Some people are paying a rate 5 times what they should. In many cases, the homeowner should not be paying taxes at all. Their income falls below the federal poverty guideline, and they should be getting an exemption.
Very often, the common scenario we see is that somebody comes in for tax foreclosure. They should have been getting it forever, for that matter. You know, they're 70 years old and their income hasn't changed in years, but they didn't know about it. So the first time they hear about it is when they're in foreclosure and about to lose their house.
Some homeowners are getting hit with both barrels. They're eligible for poverty exemption but not getting it, and they're charged taxes at an unreal rate. Walter Hicks says the assessment of his house on the west side is ridiculous.
Because what they had the house worth, that's I think $30,000 to $40,000. And when I got the house appraised, it was appraised for $9,000.
On top of that, Hicks has been eligible for the poverty exemption, but he was denied the exemption a couple of years ago. The city said he owned another house, and so he wasn't eligible for the exemption. It turns out it's someone else with the same first and last name. The clerk at the city hall told him nothing can be done about that. It's too late. Hicks explained his situation to the city. His story has been reported in the news media. Still, nothing.
Not a thing. You know, to rectify the problem, I know they done heard me. You know, I know they know the issue. You know, all I want them to do is correct the error that they made.
Now, Walter Hicks is a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP. Michael Steinberg is with the ACLU.
The bottom line is people are losing their homes for inability to pay taxes that they should never have had to pay in the first place.
The lawsuit originally charged the Wayne County Treasurer's Office and the City of Detroit with violating the Fair Housing Act. That's because black people in the county face tax foreclosure at a much higher rate than white people. A judge dismissed the case against the county, but the city is still in court. The ACLU's Steinberg also says the city is breaking state law for failing to assess home values properly.
It's tragic. You know, the fact that the city is starting to come in line with state law helps people going forward, but it really doesn't help people who, and there's tens of thousands of them who have lost their homes over the past 5 years.
In emails responding to our questions, the Detroit mayor's office showed some progress on reassessments of property. They noted a dramatic drop in foreclosures this year, about half of what they were last year, and many people were put on payment plans. The city calls the ACLU lawsuit, quote, recklessly irresponsible, and says it would threaten basic city services to all Detroiters. The city's future is threatened regardless. Here's why. Without stable home ownership in a city, nothing is stable. Peter Hammer is a professor of law at Wayne State University.
One of the most important ways in which people acquire wealth, have that wealth increase, and transfer that wealth from one generation to the other is the house.
That happened for the white middle class. New Deal programs during the Great Depression helped white people get ahead, buy homes. It did not help black people. Many African Americans who did buy a home bought it in inner cities, where values have plummeted. Instead of increasing wealth, many black families lost wealth.
You look at the household, and then you look at the city, which is really the aggregation of all the households. And the same things that are preventing the individual household from aggregating wealth and being prosperous is also undermining the ability of the whole entire city to be aggregating wealth and being prosperous.
In an effort to keep the city of Detroit afloat, the city is already taxing at a higher rate than anywhere else in the state. Its residents are among the poorest in the state. If the city is ever to see prosperity, it has to find a tax rate its citizens can afford, or it will continue to force thousands of its residents out of their homes each year.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Coming up, the Attica prison riot in 1971 was a critical moment in American history. A new book by a Michigan author has altered the common narrative of what happened.
There's much to not want to talk about, and the state of New York has been very, very careful from the moment that the tear gas cleared over Attica to today into not releasing the documents.
We'll find out what's changed in our nation's prisons and what remains the same. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, has been getting a lot of attention and was a 2016 National Book Award finalist. The author of the book is a native Detroiter and University of Michigan professor of history, Heather Ann Thompson. First, this is about a prison riot and retaliation in upstate New York. Tell us about the living conditions at the prison and some of the political climate at the time.
So this is an upstate New York prison. It's a maximum security prison. It still exists today. And interestingly, today it looks exactly as it did in 1971, which is just what it looked like in the Depression when it was built, which was archaic, very, very overcrowded, and terrible living conditions. 2,400 men crammed in this facility. Insufficient food for these men, being fed on 63 cents a day, having insufficient sanitary supplies, being treated really barbarically by the medical staff. And essentially, this is a group of men who understand that they are human beings and that they have a right to basic human rights in a prison. And they had also been inspired by the civil rights activism happening outside of prison walls. This is 1971, and very much the walls between prison and the outside were porous in terms of the idea that one could protest for better conditions.
Right, and this is an age of black empowerment. Of the prison population, about how many were African American? And I'm asking that because I wonder how much race was a factor in the events that led up and followed.
Well, there's no question that the prison is majority black and Puerto Rican, but there were many, many white prisoners in Attica as well. And indeed, this whole protest will go down as very much a black power protest, and in key ways it was. But the brutal living conditions were so much in people's minds that it united these guys across racial lines, across barriers of language. There were many Spanish-speaking prisoners in this facility, and many different political points of view. So what's really remarkable is how 1,300 men stand together on those fundamental question of rights, despite differences of race and language and politics.
The prisoners took over the prison, and like a lot of things in history, it started with a fairly minor event, but it was the culmination of all those conditions you talked about. What sparked the riot?
Well, so these guys had for months and months and months been trying to get some remedy through the system, writing letters, sending petitions, and indeed they'd even had a strike. They had sat down in the metal shop of Attica to ask for better wages and, again, better conditions. But this got them very little. And so what happened was, again, as you mentioned, a very insignificant or I should say regular incident of prison management overreacting, clamping down on prisoners, and in this case, locking them in a hallway, not letting them go out to rec one morning after breakfast, failing to tell the guards in charge of these guys that that was going to be the plan. And needless to say, that early morning on September 9th, utter chaos ensues. People are panicked. They feel like they're being trapped, that they're about ready to be descended on and beaten. And so that's where the riot begins. But within an hour, remarkable order has been established out in one of the exercise yards. And an extraordinary experiment in participatory democracy really begins.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, these guys, they moved to D Yard because they all want to be out in the open, both for their own safety and also for the safety of the guards whom they've taken hostages. They take guards hostage because they understand they need the state to bargain with them and feel pretty strongly that the state will at least protect their own. So they set up this tent city. They have a medical station, a food station. They elect representatives out of each of the cell blocks to come up to this negotiating table to speak for them. They ask for the media to come in because they understand that prisons are places where anything can go wrong because no one from the outside is ever allowed to see. So they invite the media in and they ask for observers, one of whom was Michigan's own Jim Ingram from the Michigan Chronicle. And they want those observers to come in to make sure that negotiations with the state proceed in good faith and to make sure that they are protected as they go on.
So let's get an idea. How long were the prisoners in control of Attica?
So they were there from September 9th in the early morning until the state retakes the prison that same time, early morning on September 13th.
Okay.
So four long days and long nights.
So there are negotiations going on. What kind of negotiations? What were they like between the prisoners and New York government officials?
Well, the primary negotiator for New York was the Commissioner of Corrections, a liberal prison reformer by the name of Russell Oswald. And the negotiations go on between him and, again, the elected negotiators up at the table in D Yard. And they continue with the observers being the sort of emissaries, going and hearing what the prisoners need, going back, talking to the prison administrators inside of the prison on the outside of the area controlled by the prisoners. And the demands were first unwieldy and some quite unrealistic, but through a process of consensus and much discussion and a pushing on the part of the observers to nail down, very, very clear demands, the demands were about 32 very clear-cut human rights demands ranging from, decent food to the right to practice one's religion, to more humane and clearer parole rules and so forth. Very, very basic.
So they have a sketch of an agreement. There's going to be a retaking of the prison, and that's when things really get out of hand. Tell me about that.
Well, meanwhile, while these negotiations are going on and people are putting their lives on the line to make sure that this ends peacefully, outside of the prison, every state trooper barrack had sent men to this prison, and so had corrections officers from all around the state had descended on Attica. And while these negotiations are going on for 4 days and long nights, these men are getting no sleep. They are being really fed on a diet of rumor about inmate atrocities going on the inside. This is the FBI who's helping to plant those. And they're passing out weapons. Every imaginable weapon, some state issued, being passed out of the back of trucks with no regard to serial number or who has what weapon, to personal weapons, ammunition outlawed by the Geneva Convention. And these are the men whom on the fifth morning, the governor of New York will send into this prison against the advice of everybody who was there.
A governor who we later elected or was appointed, I should say, vice president of the United States, Nelson Rockefeller. Now, the negotiators and the observers, including James Ingram of the Michigan Chronicle, decided to stay in the prison to observe the retaking of the prison, which was pretty risky. What did they see when you've got these state troopers and these correctional officers who have been, as you say, feeding on rumors for days?
Well, first, let me say for your listeners, just to get a picture of what this was like, before these nearly 600 troopers and corrections officers go into the prison, first, a very, very toxic gas had been dumped over D Yard. And this was a powder. It clung to people's noses and in their nasal passages, and they were in their throats. And so folks were already debilitated. They were retching and falling to the ground. The gas immobilizes them. And this is when the troopers proceed their physical assault on Attica. Well, meanwhile, the observers who agreed to stay, and it wasn't all of them, but it was some of them, were in the observer's room. So they couldn't see inside of the yard, but they could feel the concussion of the gunfire. They could feel the concussion of the helicopter blades going overhead, dumping the gas. And they could certainly smell. And they were, really sickened by the gas. It was actually seeping through their own door. So they felt very much a part of it, but couldn't see the horror even themselves until later.
At the end, a total of 43 people are dead, including 10 correctional officers. There was an investigation into the prison uprising and the retaliation. What was the result? Why did 43 people die?
Well, it's a complicated story because some of those people actually were killed in the recesses of the prison by some prisoners at a different time. So they're not part of that state body count that we're really talking about right now. On the day of the retaking, law enforcement guns killed 39 men, prisoners and hostages alike. And they also severely wounded, 6 to 7 bullet holes in some cases, 128 other men. So you would imagine that after this, which is literally a carnage, that there will be some accountability, particularly members of law enforcement. Well, the book that I wrote really chronicles why that never happens. Why is it that only prisoners will ever be indicted for their role in the rebellion, but law enforcement never does any time, certainly doesn't even come, has a day in court even. And that is because it turns out that the state of New York at every level of its government and then really beyond New York into the federal government, helps to cover up what happened, actively covers up what happened. And the book, spends 2/3 of the pages on that, both the cover up, but also the prisoner and hostage fight to make sure that their stories were eventually told.
The Attica uprising took place 45 years ago, but government officials are still keeping many of these documents related to what happened secret. You filed Freedom of Information requests. They came back heavily redacted. You had a hard time getting access to many of the documents. Why are we still having this secrecy surrounding an event that happened 45 years ago?
Well, that's an excellent question. Again, we need to remember that prisons, whether it's Attica in 1971 or whether it's, our own Michigan's Kinross facility today, these are public institutions. And we have, as citizens, a right to know what goes on behind those bars and behind those walls. And we don't. And so at Attica, it was extraordinarily difficult to get any information about what had gone down there in 1971, both because it was a prison, but also because, remember, 39 people have been killed by law enforcement, 128 others shot. And frankly, that's just the beginning. In the days, weeks, and months after the prison is under the control of the state, the prisoners are tortured. I mean, literally tortured. And so there's much to not want to talk about. And the state of New York has been very, very careful from the moment that the tear gas cleared over Attica to today into not releasing the documents. So my book took 13 years to write because it was about trying to figure out who had either the copy or the original of what the state didn't want me to see. That was in terms of the documents, probing what was really going on in that investigation, and frankly, talking to the survivors to make sure that I knew what happened from them.
You've been getting some great accolades from a number of reviewers and so forth, but you've also been getting some really nasty backlash from people about the revelations you make in your book, some of them really profane. Why do you think there's that reaction?
Well, it's interesting. I think part of the reaction that I've gotten is because I am a historian, but I also speak out today about prison conditions and speak out about police killings today in cities such as Charlotte, for example. I mean, some of the worst hate mail I got was after talking about the police shooting that recently happened in Charlotte, North Carolina. But there has been a great deal of at least concern, if not hostility, that I decided in this book to name the members of law enforcement who have been protected for 45 years, whom the state believed and had evidence against for killing prisoners and hostages alike, and frankly also for torturing them. So I reveal those names, and all I can say to that is it was very painful to do that because I don't want to bring anyone harm, either the victims to have to relive this or even the members of law enforcement who have, managed to protect themselves all those years. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable position when history meets the present like that for the author, for the historian. But at the same time, I am a historian. And so when I was writing what happened during the state's investigation of Attica, and part of that information was whom it believed had committed crimes there, I had no choice but to tell that part of the history too. Interestingly, the book also countless times mentions crimes that the state believed that the prisoners had done that they didn't do, right? Or that maybe sometimes they did do. But either way, nobody has ever said to me, why in the world are you dragging those men's name through the mud, especially when it's something they were not actually, had a trial for? No one cares if it's some of the hostages or the prisoners. What they care about is it's only if it's law enforcement. So I find that interesting, but I had no choice but to reveal what the history book needed to reveal to the public.
So what are the lessons yet to be learned from Attica?
Well, so many. I think first and foremost, what I hope the book does is that it reminds us all that those people who are behind bars are not something other. I mean, these are citizens. These are our mothers, our brothers, our sisters, our children. They're human beings. And that while some of them are guilty and some of them perhaps are not, the bottom line is their sentence is to be confined. It is not to be tortured. It is not to be abused. And we have a responsibility, since they have no obvious power inside of those institutions, to see what's going on. So I hope it gives us the sense of urgency that we need to know what's happening in our prisons and that we have a responsibility to make sure that that the people in them are not being abused.
Heather Ann Thompson is a history professor at the University of Michigan, author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, published by Pantheon. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Ryan Grimes. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a nice weekend.